for dinner at 8.
I'm starving.
She loves the theater, but she never comes late.
I never bother with people that I hate. That's why this chick is a tramp.
She doesn't like crap games with barons and earls.
I won't go to Harlem in diamonds and pearls. And I definitely won't dish our dirt with the rest of those girls.
Thank you. That's why the lady is a tramp.
Tony Bennett is one of the greatest singers of our time, with a career that has spanned over 6 decades. His circle of friends reads like a list of who's who from the world of 20th century arts and culture: Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Louis Armstrong, Ella Fitzgerald, Bing Crosby, Judy Garland, Martin Luther King Jr., Robert Kennedy, and of course, Frank Sinatra, who called Mr. Bennett the best singer in the business. By bucking trends and gimmicks, Tony Bennett has not only remained true to his muse, but continued to grow as an artist and earn a new generation of fans. In a memoir called Life is a Gift, The Zen of Bennett, published by Harper, Mr. Bennett reflects on the lessons he's learned about the importance of family, what constitutes success, and how he continues to grow as an artist. I'm thrilled that it has brought Tony Bennett back to our show. Hi.
Thank you very much.
Now, you've already written an autobiography. What were you hoping to accomplish with this book?
Well, I've been listening to and watching television with what they do with the young people, that the corporations, to try to get hit records for them. And there's such a walk away from quality, teaching them how to sing properly. And the whole idea of the book is to show young students that they should go to NYU and Berklee College in Boston, go to get good teachers to teach them what to expect. In other words, stay away from fame and think about longevity. Try to be in the business. If you really love what you do, and try and stay in the business for a long time instead of the tragic situation where a young person might be get a big hit record and it'll go way up for about 10 weeks and they invest all their money in it, and then it's forgotten and they end up bankrupt and forgotten. It's quite tragic. I think it's incorrect to try and get people to just make a quick buck instead of having a nice long career.
But isn't this is nothing new about this. We've seen this happen throughout the history of show business as we know it. Mm-hmm. And also, pretty much every singer I can think of, at a certain point in his or her late 30s or so, starts losing it. Are you the person to be, because you haven't, are you the person to be telling other people what to do, considering the fact that you seem to be an anomaly?
Well, I'm considered old-fashioned with a lot of people, the way I think about things. I really loved vaudeville years ago. My heroes were Jack Benny and George Burns. The fact that they lasted that long and got mellower and mellower. Louis Armstrong was the same way. Mm. And I really admired, when you asked them a question, when you had the pleasure of meeting them personally, how careful they were and how they simplified their answer. And it was so so authentic to listen to and learn from.
In fact, you talk a lot about the importance of simplification.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean exactly? Because today, most of the singers I hear use so much ornamentation in their singing, the American Idol kind of singing, that at times they almost sound like they're gargling.
Well, they're actually screaming. That they're all the amateur shows on television, American Idol and all that. They have the children screaming. It's the opposite of singing. You know, singing is a beautiful occupation. You're supposed to think of, like the word bel canto in Italian. It means beautiful singing. That's the definition of it.
And you once told me that you didn't think of yourself as much as a jazz singer as a bel canto singer.
Not really. I'm really a jazz singer.
You've changed on that,
but
Tony.
But bel canto, really, I do it in a way of intimately. I don't sing. I'm not trying to compete with Pavarotti. Yeah, it's pretty impossible.
Still, you're 85 years old. Your voice hasn't changed all that much over the years.
Well, I have a very good training. I've had very good training. I had the American Theater Wing. I was in the service, and when I came out, under the GI Bill of Rights, I joined the American Theater Wing. And it was wonderful. It was because we had won the war, everybody was so good to us. And the teachers were so excellent. And they told us never to compromise and just do quality. And when I went into the business world after school, it was unlike that. They didn't want quality. I used to meet some of my fellow students who are wonderful singers, and they said, I just auditioned, and they turned me down. And I said, how come? They said, you're singing too good. We want it to be too good.
Really?
It was strange.
Did you also study acting?
I did, yes.
Because when Frank Sinatra's voice did let him down a bit, he went through doldrums in his career, he revived his career through acting. But for you, you revived your career by singing even more.
Well, singing, I've applied the acting lessons that I've had from wonderful teachers. That teacher I had was a fellow called Slavinsky, who studied the Stanislavski test. It was on stage with Stanislavski and taught us the method of natural acting. Improvised acting. And I applied that to singing.
You mean thinking about lyrics in that way?
Well, you know, what I do, I try to find songs that I've experienced myself. And they're little short, 32 bars of songs that are very well written by wonderful composers with terrific talent. Cole Porter was the best. And the modern world says, well, that's old, you know. But to me, that's our renaissance. That was our renaissance period, the 20s, 30s, and 40s, way before my time. And they were the best. You had Gershwin, you had Cole Porter, you had Jerome Kern.
Berlin.
And Berlin, who's like Mr. America, as far as I'm concerned. His song "God Bless America" should be the national anthem. It's better. It's written better than the national anthem.
Well, sure, it's easier to sing.
Excuse me.
It's easier to sing. At the end of the national anthem, we have that weird note jump that drives people crazy.
I know.
My guest is Tony Bennett, who has written a memoir called "Life Is a Gift: The Zen of Bennett." It is published by Harper's. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Let's talk about that subtitle, The Zen of Bennett. Are you a spiritual person?
I think I am. I like it. I like the thought of, I paint also. And my good teachers, I have the best portrait painter in America, Everett Kinsler, and he's taught me an awful lot. We went to art school together when we were students years ago at the American Theater Wing, at the School of Industrial Arts. And he taught me about concentrating on nature. And the more you get into that, the more wonderful life becomes.
So you've been drawing and painting almost as long as you've been singing. Do you see similarities between the two? And were you ever tempted to give up the singing for the art?
No. I'm fortunate to have a wonderful passion at a very young age, and it has sustained throughout my life. I just want to keep improving as much as I can and learning as much as I can.
The Zen of Bennett is also the title of a documentary film that played recently at the IFC Center in Greenwich Village. Do the book and the film cover similar ground?
Pretty similar, yeah. My son did the documentary. I had nothing to do with it. They said, stay out of this. We're doing this for you. And it was very exciting. It's gotten a very nice reaction.
Your son, Danny.
My son,
who
Dan,
also works with you.
Yeah, he manages me the last 35 years.
Now, you were on the road a lot when you... In fact, you've always been on the road a lot. So how did you maintain those kinds of family connections? So a lot of families have problems when dad or mom is on the road.
I'm very surprised that things have worked out as well as they did. My whole family is involved with my work now. My daughter sings with me on the road. Antonia, she's wonderful. People love her. And then Danny, and then my other son is my recording engineer. And my granddaughter is my general photographer. So I have it all in the family, and they're all very nice people. They're all very together, and they love what they do. And it's very nice to be around your whole family.
Does that go back another generation, your parents and your siblings?
Oh, yeah. I had a wonderful upbringing, a wonderful mom. My father died when I was very young, and my mom had to raise three children. So all my Italian-American family would come around and help my mom out, knowing that she had three children and work, and you know, very hard during the Depression.
And your father died when you were 10. Your father died when you were 10.
Right.
And what had he done for a living?
He had heart failure. Hmm. And so my relatives would come over, and they would say... We would make a circle around my brother, sister, and myself. And my brother was a big influence in my life because he was trained. My mom put some money together to train him as an opera singer. And by the time he was 14, he was singing solo spots at the Metropolitan. He was a wonderful singer, big influence on my life. He was my older brother, and I was always envious and flattered by how beautiful he sang. And it came from the story of my father, who used to sing in Calabria on the top of a mountain, and the whole valley would hear him sing. And that impressed us so much. We became singers.
And what happened to your brother?
Well, as a young boy, he didn't want the discipline of it, and he changed. You know, he just went into the hairstyling business for a while, and then a restaurant business. It just never really followed it up.
Mm. So, but there was music in your family from the start. What about the painting? Is that something that you just came to on your own?
Well, once again, it was my family that my relatives would say, we love the way you paint flowers and all that. And I remember very clearly as a young boy saying, they're telling me that I sing well and I paint well, so I'm going to just keep it. Learning how to do it more and more.
What was your first paying gig? Was that before you went into the Army?
Well, yeah, it was. It happened, there was a teacher that lived in the projects where we lived for a while in Astoria, and James McWeeny, and he was a wonderful teacher. And he saw me doing a mural in the street with some chalk. And it was the Thanksgiving subject of the Indians and the people, soldiers meeting the Indians. And he said, I like what you're doing. I said, thank you, sir. And he said, you know, every Saturday I go out and paint. And if you'd like to come with me, I said, I'd love to. And I couldn't believe it. I looked over at when he was painting. And it was from a story of looking back into Manhattan. And he was painted watercolor so beautiful that I've never forgotten it. I just thought it was such a wonderful teacher. So that really started me to just say, I'm going to go this way. This is what I like.
How did growing up in Astoria prepare you for your career, do you think?
Well, they were wonderful to me because I started working in little tiny clubs. And there were a lot of great musicians that played gigs, great jazz artists that would come in and play weekends and all that. And I was a singing waiter at one of the clubs near the Astoria Park, and I would take requests and find out what they wanted to eat, and I would get money that way.
And you were, at this point, were you Tony Benedetto, or were you, had you changed your name to Tony Barry at that point?
Joe Barry.
Joe Barry?
So later on, that happened later on.
Because you were Barrez.
Yeah, right.
So, and then, but Tony Bennett just seems like the obvious name.
Well, Bob Hope gave me that name, because he said, what's your name? When I told him Joe Barry, he said, come on, that's a phony name. He said, that's a city in Italy. He said, what's your real name? I said, Anthony Dominic Benedetto. And he said, well, that's a little long for the marquee. Let's economize that, and we'll call you Tony Bennett. And so ever since then, when I paint, it's Benedetto, and when I sing, it's Tony Bennett.
But you haven't regretted for a moment being Tony Bennett, right?
No, not at all.
My guest is Tony Bennett, who has written a memoir with a foreword by Mitch Albom called Life is a Gift, The Zen of Bennett. It is published by Harper. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Let's listen to one of his most famous recordings.
The loveliness of Paris seems somehow sadly gay. The glory that was Rome is of another day. I've been terribly alone and forgotten in Manhattan. I'm going home to my city by the bay. I left my heart in San Francisco. High on a hill, it calls to me. My heart is sad and lonely. For you I sigh, for you, dear, only. Why haven't you seen it? I'm all for you, body and soul.
I spend my days at a hunger and wondering why.
Tony Bennett in duet with Amy Winehouse, the last record she ever made.
Yeah.
It sends shivers up and down my spine, partly because she was such a talent. But you write in this book, your memoir, Life is a Gift, The Zen of Bennett, about your own drug use. Was that just what people did at the time?
Everybody was doing it, the whole country at that moment.
Well, at least people in show business.
No, everywhere. Every business. It was a big illegal business. And it was regretful. I thought I was doing great, and I really wasn't. And for a while I had a manager who manages Woody Allen and Jack Rawlins. And I said, you know, we started talking about some people that he managed, and he managed Lenny Bruce. And I said, well, I knew Lenny. I said, what do you think of him? He said, he sinned against his talent. That sentence changed my life. I thought of it a lot, and I said, why sneak around corners and try and find drugs and all that? Let me stop all this and get back to just concentrating on improving my singing. And it happened, and it was a great lesson for me.
Well, not everybody can do that, as we see with Amy Winehouse and another person you collaborated with. We always talk about your duets, but it's duets with singers. But you made these incredible recordings with Bill Evans, who had serious problems with drugs.
Well, he hated that happened to him. You know, he was on heroin, and he told me, he said, I wish someone who put that needle in my arm, I would have sort of hit him and knocked him out and walked away from it all. He said, it's the worst thing that ever happened to me. And he was such a genius. It's unbelievable.
Well, those records, when they were released, nobody paid much attention to them, did they? But then now they become among the greatest jazz classics. What do you think happened? Did people just, were they a little ahead of their time?
It seems that quality has to take a back seat when it comes out. It takes about 5 years before, the Bill Evans album was out really about 6 or 7 years before anybody really started to, in the jazz world, everybody knew about it because they were into Bill Evans a lot. So they would, but really not until 6 years later when I went to Europe recently and every interview I had, they would bring up the Bill Evans album. It's really the most distinguished album I've ever made. And it was his piano playing that did it.
Well, the two of you just sound like you're so in tune with each other.
Well, but he's responsible for that. He had such an intelligent, quick way of, he'd listen to my phrasing as we were performing, and he would just support the next phrase coming up or, you know, just covering it so it, he was just a genius at what he was doing.
And with the most incredible voicings of chords. He could take a song that we knew well and find all sorts of new things in it.
Well, you know, ever since that, I listened to a lot of Bill Evans, and he does that all the time. I mean, he had such a facility. Every great jazz musician I've met since that time, all, not just to me, but they just say publicly on any interviews that they're trying to play as good as Bill Evans.
We earlier heard I Left My Heart in San Francisco. Is it true that that almost didn't get recorded?
No. Ralph Sharon was a wonderful accompanist for me, very talented guy. And we were in Little Rock, Arkansas, and we were going up to San Francisco for the first time, and he found a song that some friends gave to him, and they said, here's a song about San Francisco, and we're going up there, why don't we put that in the show? And I was rehearsing it, and a little hint about the song was a bartender that was watching the rehearsal politely interrupted us and said, I don't mean to bother you at the rehearsal, but if you record that song, I'm going to be the first customer. So it was a tip off that, and sure enough, it was a quick reaction when we went to San Francisco at the rehearsal. Everybody said, you've got to record that song. Mm-hmm. And that's how it happened.
And it continues to resonate with people.
Oh, gosh, it's wonderful.
Didn't you make a conscious decision to go after a younger, hipper audience in the 1980s?
I didn't.
You didn't?
No, my son did.
Uh-huh. But I don't know how that worked because a lot of performers have thought the same sort of thing. I have to revitalize the act, and then it doesn't happen. What did you do that was different?
I've always known. I've liked the Bing Crosby philosophy, who taught us all how to make a living. He played to the whole family. It's the society, the corporation executives came up with the fact that if they just concentrate on the young, they're going to get tremendous sales. It was a big mistake as far as I'm concerned, because if you play to the whole family, everybody will buy your records. It's a bigger audience. So it's when they told me to sing on MTV, it was a theater, kind of theater in the round setup, and it was all very young people. Well, to me, it's just an audience. I don't think of age when I perform. I like to sing for the whole family. And I just did what I do anywhere, and the audience reacts to it.
Well, you've been critical of recording company executives over the years. I would think that the record you made with Bill Evans is a perfect example of how they're often wrong. They want something that will be an instant hit, and you want to sell millions of records, and then you don't care if it disappears. Sometimes a record can stay active in a catalog for a long time, and that means constant cash flow.
Absolutely. I loved
in I'm sure Frank Sinatra's still earning a lot of money.
Absolutely.
For Capitol, and Elvis
and
is still
Ella
earning
Fitzgerald
a lot for RCA.
And Nat King Cole. Nat King Cole built Capitol Records. He built the building. Every record went to number one. And to this day, I'm convinced that, let's say, 30 or 40 or 50 years from now, if you listen to Ella Fitzgerald or Nat King Cole or Sinatra, you're going to find out that it doesn't sound dated, because it was the best orchestras, the best kind of phrasing you could possibly want from an artist.
You've talked in the past about your awareness of racism from a very early age in the military, and a lot of people were horrified by racism. It was another thing to go on the march in Selma. What led you to do that?
Well, my great friend is Harry Belafonte, who I consider America's greatest patriot. And when he told me what was going on down there, when I left the Army, I really became a pacifist. I didn't ever want to fight again, you know, after that experience. But when he told me what happened, what was going on, I'd rather not mention it on the air. But it was so horrible what he described to me, what was going on, that I said, I'm with you. I'm going.
And that's when you met Martin Luther King.
Right.
Did you maintain a relationship with him, a friendship with him?
Well, every once in a while, he'd show up at the great Carnegie Hall, and everybody was for him, and we shared a dressing room together for a while. He was just who he is. There was nobody like him.
I've mentioned other people in my introductions, Duke Ellington, for example. One of the songs that you love to perform, often without a mic, is one of Duke's favorites. Mm-hmm. You didn't mention him earlier when you mentioned great composers, but he was pretty terrific.
Oh, come
and
on,
so
was
Billy Strayhorn, who his alter ego.
That was the greatest era. I was the first white singer to sing with Count Basie. That was a little ahead of time in those days. And it was a great experience. You know.
Well, you talk about mentorship, and you say Frank Sinatra really helped you, taught you things. What did he teach you?
Well, they gave me the summer replacement for the Perry Como show once, but they kind of left me with a bare stage. It wasn't the big orchestra that Perry had and all, the great guests that he had. And so I was very nervous, and I never met Sinatra, but he was playing at the Paramount Theater, doing 7 shows a day at the Paramount Theater. And I introduced myself because I had a hit record, Because of You. And he was very nice to me, and he said, what is it, son? I said, well, I'm very nervous. I said, I told him the situation, but I'm taking over a summer replacement, and I'm left with a bare stage and all that. And I said, I don't know how to handle it. He said, well, if you're nervous, he said, just know one thing. The public is your friend. That's what he taught me. He said, if you show them that you love them, they're going to love you right back. He said, they'll help you out. So if you feel nervous, he said, don't worry about that. He said, the public's going to like that because they'll help you. And I experienced that, and ever since then, audiences are friends of mine.
And what did you do on the show? Did you just come out with a piano?
No, it wasn't that simple. We still had wonderful guests, you know, and it was a summer replacement. But just the fact that he taught me that there's nothing wrong with being nervous. That means that you just care for what you're doing.
And you cite some other people who have given you good advice over the years. Pearl Bailey, Ella Fitzgerald, Bob Hope, Fred Astaire.
Oh, yeah. They're all good.
Do you
George
try to
Burns.
Pass it on? Oh, George Burns.
Yeah.
Do you try to do the same thing if somebody comes up to you with the kind of question you ask Sinatra?
Mm-hmm.
What do you tell?
Well, that's what the book is about, really. The gift of life is you know, it's about showing the young people that they look out for fame. It's going to be quick, and it's going to be over with, and then you'll be forgotten, and it'll be tragic for your life, a feeling of failure. Know that it's a long-term thing, and encouraging them to read everything and go to schools and have good teachers show you just what to do and how long it's really going to take for you to learn.
And what did George Burns tell you?
Well, he told me, he said, son, you're getting a good start. He said,
they all called you son. You're 86 now, right?
Yeah, right. Well, no, this was years ago. And he said, it's going to take you 6 or 7 years to really become a consummate performer. You know, just know that audiences are going to become your great teachers. Every night when you perform, you'll learn something from them.
Just one more thing. You have been doing a lot of duets, and you sound like you're really enjoying them. And when the person you're singing with does something quite special, you often chuckle to yourself.
Right.
Is that with
Lady Gaga, right? Because she's so talented. I mean, I was shocked as to how talented she is. In fact, just yesterday, she called me from Peru. She's all over the world and doing great, and she has an ambition to do an album with me, and that's going to become my next album. We're doing an album together with Lady Gaga.
Mm. You're not going to have to wear a meat suit, are you? when you perform on stage. And what kinds of songs would you sing with Lady Gaga? You're not going to sing rock songs, are you?
No, not at all. I'm going to prove to the audience that she's going to sing songs that will outlast any new fad, whatever it may be. The songs of Harry Warren, all the great movie songs that he wrote.
Mm-hmm. So you stay true to the Great American Songbook.
Mm-hmm.
Well, do you ever imagine singing one of the newer songs? Ella Fitzgerald did a Beatles album.
Well, no, I like Cole Porter.
Well, I don't blame you. I do, too. How did you get Mitch Albom to write a foreword for you?
We're just great friends. We hit it off, and he's such a... We're going to do a benefit for him for Haiti. Mm-hmm. He's really concentrating on helping the young students and children of Haiti. He's such a wonderful person. I love the way he writes, and what an honor it is to have him write the introduction to the book.
And the book also has lots of photographs, and it has some of your illustrations as well.
Thank you.
It is called Life is a Gift, The Zen of Bennett, words and artwork by Tony Bennett, with a foreword by Mitch Albom, published by Harper. And Tony, it's always a great pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you
so much
for
coming by.
I loved it. Thank you.